Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another live edition of Midrats. And if you find yourself with that gilded cohort of live listeners, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. If you have some observations you want to share during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guest during the next hour, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring it as the show progresses. And if you got to run off and watch some basketball or do something else, you can always get what you missed over at the full archive at Blog Talk Radio, or take a few seconds and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Now, diving into today's show, if you've kind of lost the lock on what's going on in the national security world in our 24-hour, now shifting to every 30-minute news cycle, first of all, don't feel bad. You're not alone. There's a lot of distractions out there, but you've definitely picked the right spot to spend the next hour with. Because we brought on board one of the folks that not only is in the center, he's all over the place inside D.C. in the national security arena and has been for a long time, returning guest Phil Ewing. Phil is NPR's national security editor, where he's been since 2015 when he came from Politico. He also was the Pentagon correspondent and defense editor there. Before then, he was with military.com, and before that, he covered the U.S. Navy for Military Times newspapers. Phil, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks so much for having me, you guys. It's great to be here.
Really happy to have you on board. I thought we would kick it off as a gentleman who makes his living as a reporter and has dedicated years in studying, following, talking about issues related to the U.S. military, not just the U.S. Navy, obviously. You've seen a lot of trends, a lot of personalities come and go, different PAOs, different approaches to working with the press. And something different took place, at least I became aware of it, into summer, early fall, that started with the Navy at the prompting of, I think it's fair to say, that the CNO. And now it's moved on to the Air Force, and you can just see it spreading like an ink spot. And that's a retreat from active engagement with the press and the general public. And as somebody, this is your bread and butter, and you're right there at the front. I just wanted to kick off the show today, and if you could talk to us for a bit about that process, what you've seen from your perspective and some of your views, plus, minus, or otherwise, on how this is impacting the American taxpayers' ability to know what their money's going toward.
Well, I definitely come at that question as somebody who has a point of view, because I need to be able to get as much information and access as I can, and certainly my colleagues do, to be able to do our work, which is part of the process of telling those taxpayers you mentioned and people in Washington and outside of Washington, what this incredibly huge and expensive and complicated and incredibly successful but also deeply troubled national security infrastructure that we have in this country is doing, which is kind of where that's the little ditch that I've dug myself for my career since I've been in Washington. And to do that, it depends on, unfortunately, the goodwill of the participants who are running the show at any given time. And every time you get a new presidential administration, there's a little bit of a recalibration, because you have a new guy at the top, you have new people that he or she brings in this case he, and the culture and the decision-making starts to flow from there, which is what I think is the origin of the phenomenon you described. Part of it is just a new president, a new administration, trying to do things a different way, trying to put their own stamp on some of the longstanding conflicts and storylines that have always been a part of life, or at least they have for a very long time, whether you're talking about counterterrorism, whether you're talking about the Taliban, whether you're talking about the big kind of great power story that has been really coming back over the past couple of years, via some of the other foreign powers that are out there. And everything from that kind of takes on a different flavor depending on the day and the week. So there's a new administration, that's point one. There's an administration with a principal in the president who really likes to be at the center of a lot of coverage and really make the fish jump by throwing as much dynamite in the pond as he possibly can. And what that has meant for the entire government, not just the IC, not just the Defense Department, not just the kind of the aquarium that I swim in, is people have been trying to get out of the way to keep his lane as clear as they possibly can. What does that mean? It means that you have another guy at the Defense Department, Secretary Mattis, who was never that aggressive about getting out there and mixing it up with reporters to begin with. That comes from way back in the day when he was wearing the uniform as a Marine Corps four-star. He was a combatant commander in Central Command. He had a lot of other important posts before that, and he was very leery about the value that he thought he could get out of engaging too meaningfully or for very long with people at any one time. And when you have two very important principals like the commander-in-chief and then SecDef setting the tone, that sets the tone in a very easy way for everyone else who, again, you know, are relatively new in their jobs and are feeling a little bit constrained about how much they want to talk, what kind of access they want to grant, what kind of stories they think people should tell if they can't control those stories. And that's what you've seen with the CNO, and that's what you're seeing with CSAF and the Air Force most recently. And so on the one hand, you can sympathize because these are guys who are – they haven't been service chiefs for a very long time. They've got a new SecDef. The SecDef is very unusual in the sense that he was a four-star senior COCOM living legend in Jim Mattis, who's kind of come back for this very strange coda to his career. He's wearing a suit now instead of uniform running the Defense Department, and he's working for a guy in the president who really likes his press and who really wants to be the center of attention. And I think when you throw all those ingredients together, you get a retrenching of a longstanding policy in the case of these two blue services, which could only increase as we go forward. I don't pay as much attention as I used to, and some of my colleagues do, to the green services, so I can't speak as much about them and where they are on this question of engagement or telling their stories or working with public affairs. But I would not be surprised if somebody said, you know, General Milley, the Marine Corps Commandant, they're doing the same thing. I should be clear, General Milley is the Army Chief of Staff. And then you also have the Marine Corps Commandant. He's the other principal here. But if they're pulling back as well, if they're doing less, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
With the proposed appointments of Bolton, Pompeo, and Haspel as key figures in the national security apparatus, do you foresee them being in this same mode of maintaining low profile so the president can have the spotlight on him? Or is this going I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, it's a fascinating question because Gina Haspel is this very unusual figure who, until I think 2 years ago or even more recently, literally was living undercover. You know, she was a clandestine officer for her entire career. And she's a lifer, you know. She's been at CIA since 1985, if I remember correctly. And nobody knew her name and nobody saw her picture until she got the job to serve as deputy, which I think was at the beginning of 2017, if I remember that date correctly. And it's very unusual. You guys know from looking at this and from dealing with people over the course of their careers, especially inside the military side of the house, you can spot a guy like your young, hot-running captain who then gets to become an admiral, who then goes to a top job, and then all of a sudden – that person's a very visible three-star, and you just know they have that special light around them. You know, you've seen it so many times, irrespective of the service. That person is going to go on to some high-profile job in the corporation, whatever it happens to be. It's very unusual. Somebody just shows up, you know, some figure walks in the door. You've never heard their name before. You've never seen their face. And all of a sudden, in this case, they're going to be director of the CIA. And I can't imagine that, given the reluctance of anyone in that position, and especially somebody like her, that she's going to be, you know, knocking on the door of my colleagues at NPR or my colleagues at the Washington Post, for example, and saying, "Hey, I'm here. I just want to hang out. You guys can take my picture. We'll talk about my views about national security." Mike Pompeo at State Department is going to be a fascinating example of this because, you know, he doesn't come from that world. He was in the Army earlier in his career, but he's a political guy. He was in Congress and the House. He's a very polished talker. He's a very sophisticated communicator. He can deal with reporters. He can deal with storylines that he wants to tell. And if he goes to the State Department job, he will be in a position, if he continues that, very different from the guy he's replacing in Rex Tillerson. Tillerson was this very strange, slow-talking old man from Texas who had been running this, you know, giant corporation at Exxon basically as an office of the CEO. And I don't know enough about the State Department to know how much it's like or dislike Exxon, but I don't think it's that close. And so one of the problems that he had was he came from a world where you could kind of pay as much attention as you wanted and the oil would still keep pumping out of the ground and the tankers would continue sailing on the high seas, taking crude wherever you needed it to go. But the government doesn't work that way. The State Department certainly doesn't work that way. And so Pompeo not only has a challenge to reverse that trend in terms of running the department internally, but it's going to be very interesting to your question about whether he reverses what was a little bit of a closed mouth imperial style with Tillerson. He didn't like to take reporters on trips with him. He would, you know, fly places and not take anybody, which is very unusual. Principals at that level, whether you're Secretary of State, SecDef, the COCOMs, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, they very often travel with a pool. And one of the changes my colleagues who are still in the Defense Department complain about is, you know, if you can't go with those guys and at least see what they're seeing or be in the same place as they are, it's very difficult to tell their story. And these guys haven't been doing that. This CNO hasn't been doing that. CSAF hasn't been doing that. And these principals at the cabinet level haven't either. So if Pompeo comes in and he flies around the world and continues that trend, my colleagues certainly are going to complain about it. And I don't know how well we're going to be able to tell that story of how well he's doing and what kind of diplomat he's serving as at the head of the State Department.
I'm really glad to hear that take on Pompeo because I when you think of all the cabinet positions, especially somebody such as the Secretary of State, who I think, if my civics class in eighth grade served me well, is fourth in line to the president, should be open, should be out and talking to, you know, that's part of diplomacy, both behind the closed door, but also setting that message. So I think there have been a lot of the usual partisan slapping about Pompeo, but I think that is a positive development over at State. But we'll see how that plays out.
It kind of it depends. It depends a lot on the choices that he makes and the assignments that he gets from his boss, the president. Because what has made Pompeo successful in terms of dealing with Trump is he's there with him in the Oval Office every day. They're clearly simpatico in terms of their personal style. They like each other. I've heard people who cover the White House who are my colleagues say one reason Trump likes Pompeo so much is he kind of articulates the views that Trump has in ways that go over with the AI rubber chicken lunch. Or, you know, he can go into a room up in Montgomery County or out in Georgetown and say the things the president wants him to say in a way that just kind of goes over with that audience much better than the Trump's personal style is. But the challenge is to be Secretary of State, you kind of have to be out in the world. And some of the practitioners whose names we remember, you know, your Kissingers and people like them, they spent a lot of their time out of Washington flying between, you know, in his case, Egypt and Israel back in the old days, people like that. And so if the value of that relationship from the president's perspective comes from his personal connection to Pompeo, but Pompeo isn't there because he's out being America's top plenipotentiary extraordinary, making all these trips around the world, how well is that going to work? I don't know the answer. I don't think anybody does. And I think that's going to be one of the things next month when he has his confirmation hearing, you'll hear people ask him about, because what Senator Corker, who's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and other especially Republicans who are the National interest national security types don't want is for a Secretary of State who just serves as a in-town advisor to the president. They want somebody who's going to be out there with all the other foreign emissaries and diplomats overseas. But we're living in a new world. And if Trump wants to have Pompeo around and he wants to stay around and kind of be a Washington Secretary of State, then that's a choice that they can make. And we'll just have to watch kind of in real time how well they do it.
How about Bolton? We haven't really hit on him. He's an old D.C. hand. Is this a plus or minus for the Trump administration?
Well, you know, it is a fascinating choice. There was a great passage in the much-discussed Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury, about the early campaign and the Trump administration that included this great passage in which the president's one-time chief counselor, Steve Bannon, said, you know, they looked at Bannon. Trump likes Bannon. He likes his views that he's expressed, but he can't stand his mustache. And I used to tell my colleagues, you know, if you see Bannon at the White House or if you see him on TV and he still has his mustache, that means he's not going to get the National Security Advisor job. And apparently something changed because, as we saw last week, General McMaster is going to be out. He's going to retire from the Army. And Bolton is going to come in and take over. And based on the pictures that I saw of him on TV, he still has the mustache, which means Trump was apparently able to find enough that he liked about Bolton's views or had a good enough interview with Bolton at some point along the line that he was able to overcome that objection. But they're very different guys if you think about their views. Trump was a dove on Iraq, and he made a lot of hay during the campaign about how he had opposed the invasion and he thought the whole adventure in the Middle East from the George W. Bush era was a mistake. There's some fact-checking to be done about that, but we'll leave that aside for a second. And Bolton is one of those guys. You know, he was ambassador to the United Nations back then. He was an incredibly hard-driving, you know, bare-knuckle type guy in terms of dealing with foreign diplomats and being very dismissive about the value of the international diplo complex that you have at the United Nations, which is where I was working. And Bolton himself over the past couple of days has said, this isn't about me, this is about executing the president's vision. But if you got a guy like Bolton who's very interventionist, who's very hawkish, and you've got a guy like Trump whose public comments anyway are very dovish on those types of issues and who has kind of really regretted, I think, the McMaster choice, the way they make that work or the way it doesn't work is going to be yet another of these fascinating stories. You know, I think Trump thought that McMaster was going to be a different guy than he turned out to be, in the same way that he may have thought that General Mattis was going to be a different SecDef than he has turned out to be. But Mattis and McMaster basically brought Trump a form for Afghanistan and said, just take off the expiration date. And the president, in his own words, whenever that was a couple of months ago, I've lost all sense of timing with this the flow of news. He said, I wanted to cut bait on this war, but these guys said we have to double down. And he wound up doing the exact opposite of what he wanted to do because, you know, the alternatives in terms of withdrawing all American forces from Afghanistan or some kind of weird Eric Prince plan where you have contractors take over there, if that was ever seriously contemplated, they just decided they couldn't make it work. And so McMaster put them in a situation where the new policy was, we're going to commit forever. And I don't think the president was happy about that at all. He certainly said he wasn't. And after that happened, he started to look for somebody new. And if Bolton is going to be able to make this job work, he's going to have to find a way to bring options to the president that the president likes, because you've seen with the dismissal of McMaster, you've seen with the dismissal of Gary Cohn, you've seen with the dismissal of the Secretary of State, Mr. Tillerson, that when the president gets advice he doesn't like from his people, he fires them. And if Bolton's going to have any job security, that's going to be a very difficult tightrope for him to walk.
Yeah, you could spend almost a entire show with a clinical psychiatrist about the downside of firing everybody that brings you a contrary opinion. I've seen it in commands. It doesn't work too well. Hopefully it's a different dynamic up at the top. I wanted to do a little time travel with you here, kind of related to what we started the show with. Earlier today, Rick Leventhal put out a little tweet reminder. 15 years ago, he was stuck in that sandstorm that caused an operational pause. the invasion of Iraq, separate for all the other issues, it almost seems to me a high water mark for how we communicated, we being the, well, not we anymore, I'm a retired guy, how the U.S. military interacted with the press. You had embeds and units all over the place. A lot of them were reported in real time. Besides Geraldo's finger in the sand, there really wasn't much OPSEC problems per se. Do you think that 2003, 15 years ago, was the high water mark or part of a plateau on in the post-Vietnam era, how the U.S. military felt about and worked with the press? And in the 15 years from that data storm that Rick mentioned, where do you see that relationship trending from a relationship point of view?
I really do think it was a high watermark. And one reason is, if you just in human nature put some stranger amid a infantry platoon that's fighting every day for their lives, or they're in the first couple of days after Baghdad is captured, and they're helping the Iraqis pull down the statues of Saddam Hussein, or they're breaking open the Republican Guard granary, and they're handing out chickens to people in the neighborhood, or they're helping people get clean water for the first time. A lot of the stories that you got in that phase of the war very early on, 15 years ago, there's going to be a really strong relationship there, because those experiences go beyond whether you're wearing the uniform or not and just become human experiences. I wasn't around for that part of the story, but I know many people who were, and I've certainly read many accounts from reporters and photographers, newspaper, TV, radio, and others about the type of bonds that they formed with people that they still know today. And a lot of those guys are out, and they've been out for a long time, but those relationships never go away because of the closeness. And you can't help but see that closeness and the power of those experiences in the coverage that comes out of it. And a lot of times what happened was, you got a story about a unit, the more time that passed, that was like, well, we're artillery guys, but they've made us give up our guns, and now we're walking foot patrols. And we don't like that because we're not infantrymen and we didn't sign up for this, but we're going to do our best. And that's just the lot that we've drawn at this phase in the war. Or you saw a lot of coverage about guys who were saying, you know, we're in the eye of the storm here. There's a lot of chaos taking place. Higher authorities kind of dropped the ball here. No one knows what's going on, but we're doing our best. And we're gonna get through this together. And that Band of Brothers story is so powerful and so compelling for a lot of people. It actually winds up being positive from the Defense Department's perspective, because what's the story they want to tell? They want to tell stories about G.I. Joe and G.I. Jane serving together, getting over adversity, dealing with frustrations, whether it's something that is the fault of the Army in this case or not. And I think they were very pleased with how that came through. And there was certainly a ton of it. I mean, there were people, former colleagues that I used to have, who were working for like the local newspaper up at Fort Lewis. And he was going and, you know, spending a tour with the second striker. Whatever striker unit was out of Fort Lewis. And like that amount of credibility that you get from having your local reporter come from the local newspaper and go to Iraq and serve for some months in Baghdad and come back and write about it, it was really good. And then what eventually happened is the news business started to change. The amount of support for that type of work started to go away. And more recently, the interest of the Defense Department in supporting that type of coverage also changed. And the big watermark was after the formal withdrawal from Iraq in 2011, it was the policy of the Obama administration to kind of pretend like there was no more conflict in Iraq, even though it didn't take very long for the conflict to start back up again. By 2014, you had ISIS taking over the entire north of the country, the much vaunted Iraqi forces that the United States had paid all those billions of dollars to train and equip, you know, folded like a cheap suit up in the north with the fall of Mosul. And the Obama administration did not want that story to be told. And so all of a sudden it became very difficult for my colleagues to get to places like Erbil, certainly to get to Syria. That's changed somewhat more recently because the story in Syria, at least from a kind of battlefield perspective, has been positive. And if you look at a map and you had a red area of where ISIS used to control and you have a white area where it's been liberated by American or allied forces now, that certainly is a story that the Defense Department wants to tell. But they're not supporting the operations that they were 15 years ago at the beginning of the Iraq invasion because it's too hard to control the story. I also think it may be too dangerous to countenance the deployment of so many fewer journalists. In 2003, you had so many more news organizations that were willing to send so many more people. Just the law of averages meant you were going to have a large pool of press in the country and a large amount of coverage. But these days, so many fewer comparatively news organizations can do that. You have a couple of TV networks, you have one or two radio broadcasters, you have a couple of big newspapers, and you know those are big brand name newspapers: Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, and very few others. And when you have that few people, it's easier to turn them away, or it's easier to control their access in the way that CENTCOM certainly has in the past couple of years. I give General Votel a lot of credit because a couple of years ago, all of a sudden he popped up in northern Syria with Bob Burns of the AP and Barbara Starr of CNN and some of my other former colleagues from the Pentagon, and he took them to a base where the Army SF guys were training the Syrians. And there were some Syrians who talked on camera to CNN and said, "We're really frustrated. We want heavier weapons from the United States. We want more ammunition. We want them to give us TOW missiles or javelins or heavy vehicles and really do a much better job going against ISIS here, but they won't do it." And Votel was there and CENTCOM was there, and they probably could have raised a stink with CNN and not had them show that video. And they let them do it, or they didn't object because General Votel had made this commitment to let Barbara and her crew tell the story that they found when they got there. But that's pretty unusual. And the mentality has been, this conflict makes us look bad. This was arguably a failure by the United States and certainly its ally. But, there were some political decisions that drove the way security policy worked in Iraq and later Syria. And when that's the issue, the willingness to entertain that coverage certainly dials back. And unfortunately, you're in a situation where you really can't tell the story as effectively as I certainly would argue that you should. And Americans, I would also argue, deserve that it be told, including, President Trump himself had a TV interview relatively early on. And he said to the interviewer something like, "We're not going into Syria. We're not doing that. You know, we're not going to expand this conflict," at a time when there were 1,000 plus more American troops already in Syria, and they had already been there. And the Defense Department had done such an effective job at messaging that there was no or very small American presence in Syria that the president himself didn't know about it. And he was able to say that to a TV reporter, I forget who it was, and that TV reporter didn't challenge him. He just kind of said, "Yes, okay," and moved on to the next question in a way that wouldn't have been possible for President Obama or President George W. Bush, certainly, because everyone knew because of the amount of coverage that was taking place about all those forces that were in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then, of course, later on in northern Syria.
How much of that is related to simple fatigue? About war fatigue among the American public, and is there an interest in the public, or is this one of those things where the press has the obligation to tell the public what's happening, even if the people don't care about it anymore or are uninterested? That's part one. Part two is, are we seeing a similar thing with whatever we've got going on in Africa at this time?
Yeah, I think that's right. My colleague, T.M. Gibbons Neff, formerly of the WAPO, now of the New York Times, made a great point one time, which was that, you know, Afghanistan is like the opposite of news. If you do a story about Afghanistan, whether it's a new report about reconstruction or a battlefield update or even some of the really kind of explosive, relatively new news about the support that the Russians are giving to Taliban or other Taliban-allied fighters up in the north, including weapons they're using to attack American and the indigenous government forces, you can't get anybody to read it. And we live in an era now, this is something else that's changed since 15 years ago in Iraq, where I can tell you, not as I sit here, but my colleagues can tell you with Jesuitical granularity exactly how many people read how much of a story for how long on our website. And just when you have that fidelity of metrics about the way stories work and the way topics work as a part of your news report, you can tell, as TM argued, people just do not want to look at Afghanistan. It is America's, you know, crazy old aunt in the attic. We just pretend it's not there. It's easier for us not to talk about. And the sad dilemma for three consecutive administrations is, you know, the United States has stepped into this bear trap, and it's painful to keep your foot in the trap, but it's also painful to try to take your foot out. And so the decision that we've made as a nation is for the government to continue with this policy because there's no alternative in the view of President Trump and his advisors, and for Americans apparently to just pretend like it's taking place, to just turn away. I get into a lot of threads on the social networks with a lot of my colleagues here in Washington about what Admiral Mullen used to call the civil-military divide, or the gap, as he would sometimes call it. And when he first started to talk about this in, you know, 2009 or 2010, it was a big deal because there were 150,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, and there were still a lot of hot kinetic operations taking place. And it was a real issue in his view of how much many Americans had turned away from the ongoing conflicts. And, you know, they would stand up at a baseball game for the national anthem and give a round of applause for troops that had just come back. And everyone loves when the Thunderbirds fly over at the Super Bowl. But most of the time, in most places, people did not have a good sense of what those troops were doing overseas. And that certainly remains the case with the added phenomenon that there are many fewer of them over there. And I don't know how to explain it, and I don't know what the answer is or whether it's even necessarily a bad thing, because when you have a high level of engagement, when you have people pitted against each other because they're divided over a deadly conflict overseas, you get something that looks like Vietnam. And does anyone really want that? And do we want our nation to go through that in the way that it did in the 60s and 70s? And I don't know the answer to either question, but that's kind of the dynamic in Washington today in terms of the messaging. If you have people who don't want to pay attention, and you have a government and a Defense Department that don't want to talk, as we've been complaining about, as I've been complaining about, you get a situation where the conflicts never end. They just kind of go off on autopilot. And if you're on the outside of the aquarium, as I am, you know, banging against the glass to try to get the fish to pay attention, it makes it all the more difficult to get any kind of effect out of that.
Yeah, I don't have an answer either. And I think what's interesting is you touched on something that you got to wonder how it impacts how we try to report and to discuss issues, and that's the metrics. Where, and I'm sure you've seen this, where you've put a lot of blood, sweat, and treasure into an article, and you put it out there, and you think everybody's going to find it interesting, and it's covered up with tumbleweeds. Nobody cares. Or you slap something together on a topic you don't think is interesting and it blows up. Everybody finds it interesting, but you do know really fast. And so things really don't have time to soak in. I wanted to ask you a question, Phil. I read something really interesting that I tried to say, what if this happened here, what the reaction would be, and kind of use this real world situation to talk about the European press that specializes in national security issues. And that last week, the Belgian Air Force chief and two other generals were suspended because they hid from their own defense minister a study that came out and said, in essence, we don't need to be that much in a hurry with F-35. We have more years in our F-16s than we actually think we have. And I don't know why they thought they could hold that in a jar for so long. And I wondered from your point of view here, how do you see the European press, how they report, look at, or think about, especially their defense industry, compared to how we do in the U.S.? And while we're at it, in the U.S., if as some people might call him General Thunder Chief, decided that he wanted to hide a report from Secretary Mattis, how we might report on that here.
You know, that's a fascinating story. I haven't heard that Belgian storyline, but I can say from having been around for something like this involving our mutual friend, General Thunderchief, there was a big brouhaha a couple years in the Air Force. I'm going to get the dates wrong because, again, my life is not my own and time no longer has any meaning for me. But the Air Force was having one of its regular battles in Congress over the future of the 810 Warthog, the 1970s era tactical tank busting attack jet that everyone loves or everyone says they love, but which the Air Force does not want to continue flying for a number of what it calls budget and tactical reasons. And there was a unit commander, which I believe was somebody out west, maybe in Colorado or maybe down at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, which I believe is in Arizona. And he said, if you're out there talking with the press or if you're talking with members of Congress about the A-10's capabilities in a way that hurts our service position, you're guilty of treason. And this, I want to say it was somebody like a colonel, like a wing commander, and he got everyone for an all-hands call and said, you are not going to talk with members of Congress about this airplane. You're not going to talk with reporters because our Air Force General Thunderchief wants it to go away, and we are in a position where anyone who helps the supporters of this aircraft is going to be hurting our Air Force because we have dollars set aside that we want to spend in another way. And it turned out to be a huge problem for them because, among others, Arizona Congresswoman Martha McSally and others who are big supporters in Congress of the A-10 got wind of this. It was reported on a blog called John Q. Public, which covers the Air Force issues. And it turned out to be a huge black eye for them because, among other things, I think there's a law that circumscribes a military commander from telling people in a unit, you can't talk with Congress about issues that are material to oversight of the military and the budget. I don't think there's anything like that about the press, at least I wish there were, but the message was still the same. And the Air Force got slapped down. And if I remember correctly, the CSAF and SECF at the time, this was back during the last administration, had to go to Congress and say, we're not going to do this. We are not defending the comments or the actions by this particular wing commander, and we're going to be forthright with you, and we'll give you our political view, which is that we want this airplane to go away, but we're not going to keep information from you or lie to you about it. And that sounds like a very similar situation with the Belgian story that you talked about. I have been to DINFOs and other places a couple times to talk with public affairs officers, and the takeaway that I always try to leave them with is the big American Fortune 10, Fortune 100 corporations would kill to have a brand as strong as the brand that you're representing as a public affairs officer. Americans love the military, and they don't care about the details. They don't know the kind of things that those of us inside the family know about. Sometimes things don't go the way you want. Sometimes a program doesn't work out the way it was intended to do. Sometimes, if you can believe this, every dollar spent by the Defense Department is not necessarily used as efficiently or wisely as it might have been. They don't care about that. They love their uniformed services, and they will give them a huge amount of grace no matter what the story is. And having gone through a couple of very unpleasant and ugly evolutions in my career, it's been amazing to me how the overall perceptions that you see both from places like Gallup or Zogby or some of the other opinion polling that's done on this, and also just individually from people, it very seldom puts a ding in what is one of the strongest brands, if you want to call it that, that's available now. The story about the guy from, I think he also was from Fort Lewis, who went out of his FOB in Afghanistan and killed a whole bunch of people in a village there in cold blood. It was a horrible story. And then more recently, you had those two Navy destroyers in the Western Pacific that had these deadly collisions with other ships, the USS Fitzgerald and the USS John S. McCain. People were horrified by the loss of life. They were horrified by the crimes and the failures to the extent that they took place. But the perception of the Army and the perception of the Navy in those two cases, I don't think took a hit whatsoever. And, it's one of the most interesting things about this beat, because there's no amount of news you can do in which the Defense Department or one of the military services has had a problem or is managing a scandal that appears to affect the overall perception in which Americans hold the military services and the Defense Department, which is to their great credit. The European phenomenon is quite different, and that's one of the fascinating things to me about it, because in our world, I don't think it would be acceptable for the Congress or the military services to say something like you described, where they were saying, well, you know, we could have this newer, nicer platform, but we're not going to do that because it would cost too much money and nobody really cares, and we're Belgium, so no one's going to notice if we don't do it anyway. But in the European context, that definitely does seem to be a valid impression. I'm a student, just kind of as a hobby, of the conduct of the British military services, because I am kind of an Anglophile, and I just think it's interesting to see a military and a culture that critics could argue are maybe 10 or 15 years ahead of where the United States could go, depending on the way things work out. And the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force have this problem all the time. They buy platforms, but they don't buy weapons. Or they buy platforms and they don't really work because the government is much more open about using, for example, the Type 45 destroyer program as simple industrial policy for especially the big shipyards up in Scotland and BAE Systems, which is one of their big vendors over there. And in terms of fielding an operational ship, yeah, that's important. But, you know, these were ships that went into service without surface-to-air missiles, if memory serves. They're ships that were fitted with the capability to take aboard something the size of a Mark 41 vertical launch cell like we have on our DDG-51. They just don't. So they could, if there were a conflict or if some future government changed its mind, take aboard heavier, more modern, more practical weapons. They just don't do that because there isn't the kind of political support in the British context or the European context more broadly that we have in the United States for military policy. You can imagine what would happen if a combatant commander or a service chief went to Congress and said, we could have all this stuff that would make our forces more lethal and more effective. We just don't because you members of Congress are too cheap. That's one of the stories we were talking about, the invasion of Iraq from a few minutes ago, from 15 years ago. That's one of the stories that came out of that war. You know, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you'd like to have or the army you might have someday. And Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, paid the price for that comment and that policy with his job, because when American troops began dying because they were in Humvees that weren't equipped to face the threat of the time and they were getting blown up by roadside bombs and explosively formed penetrators, the Bush administration had to work double quick to get a new fleet of vehicles into service to be able to answer that problem, which is where you got the mine resistant ambush protected MRAP vehicle that a lot of us remember. It came at a huge cost. It came at a huge amount of China broken in terms of defense policy. But it was definitely a result that Congress demanded and that Americans expected. And I just don't have the impression that in the European context, people feel that way. Clearly, if they were in a hot war, that would be different. But they're kind of out of that business. And for all the deployments that the European allies did to Afghanistan, they've kept back from the kinetic side of the way things work as compared certainly with the Brits and definitely with the United States. So it just shows you how different our political cultures are compared to here.
Well, since you raised the question of budgeting, let's talk a little bit about the defense budget and the intelligence budget. Does what we're doing make any sense at all from your position?
It's certainly good for all the incumbents in the Defense Department. The president came out on Friday in what was kind of a very, very bizarre turn of events, having previewed on Twitter that he might veto the $1.3 trillion omnibus bill that Congress passed last week. And then when he got everyone's attention and everyone tuned into TV, he said, oh, I just signed the thing. And the reason I did it was to protect the acquisitions that we have in the force. And he then read off a number of programs, which I know people in the Army and the Navy and the Air Force were probably pretty happy about, as an expression of, again, that political support that he wants to be seen giving to the current programs and which Americans expect. The dilemma is clearly, I don't know if you can spend enough money and get to the force that the military services say they want. And, you know, just talking about the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and all the things that have taken place then in this world, it just kind of makes me remember that there was a kind of perfect experiment where you have a huge spike in spending across the force, and you give these military services, whether they're directly engaged or not, a great deal more budget authority, and you can kind of see what happened. And we have enough time to know that a lot of that money was effective because it bought things like MRAPs, it got the green services especially to a very sharp, ready posture where they were able to take the missions they were assigned and continue to take them to this day. And especially in terms of the special operations forces, you know, JSOC and SOCOM are worn out because they've been deploying constantly since then, but they're in the greatest shape they've ever been. And they're capable of taking virtually any assignment in a way that they certainly wouldn't have been before the conflicts. But the further afield you get from the operational forces, the murkier the picture becomes. And when you look at the blue forces, especially, you know, the Navy wants to get to a certain fleet. It wants 355 ships. The Air Force wants a certain mix of new generation aircraft and support aircraft, including the Ground Moving Target Indicator platform today, the J-STARS, whatever the future J-STARS would become. And it's not clear whether they're going to be able to get there. And in fact, the services are in a position right now to get to a place that Sal used to call on his blog the terrible 20s, where, you know, you have all this equipment that's in full rate production. Can you actually build it all with the amount of money that you're getting? And, oh, by the way, is what you're building the right total mix, because you're leaving a lot of things on the cutting room floor? And in the case of the Air Force, you're going to build F-35, the B-21 and the new tanker all at the same time. Maybe you can afford that, but you're not going to be building some new penetrating stealth aircraft necessarily. You're not going to be building a new J-STARS. And in the context of the Navy, we had a whole wave of surface programs that kind of pooped out, even though you had all this wave of money that came across as a part of that spike in Iraq spending. And the amount of ships the Navy can put at sea today are what they are, that, you know, is stable today. But you're not going to be able to build up to the level where the service wants to go, even though we've just come out of an era where we've spent all this money, because every dollar that you spend doesn't necessarily buy capability on the back end. I know you guys know this story better than anyone, but it just kind of raises this point where you get to a point where you might have diminishing returns, or you get to a point where you can't get the results that you want, you know, by the PowerPoint slides that you're getting from these service leaders by doing the same things that they've been doing in the past. And I don't know if you can get to a point where, with all the other chief cooks and bottle washers and legacy interests and kind of old practices of the military services, you can actually build out and get to the place you want to go. Maybe you can down the line if you spend a lot more money, but the more money you spend, the more sophisticated the programs tend to get, and the fewer ships, in the case of the Navy, you wind up being able to buy. I think that's the world that we're just going to have to live in. The interesting thing about it is the rest of the world isn't held constant, as we know. And if you're a sub four and you want X number of fast attack submarines, you're probably not going to get there, but there's a lot of other naval powers around the world that are doing R&D and that are spending a lot of money, and they may get where they want to get, even though the U.S. Navy can't get where it wants to get. It's too soon to say what the answer is, but that's definitely the way the trend lines look to me as we're sitting here.
When you're talking about the poop parade of some of our programs, you know, when I first started going with the old terrible 20s thing, heck, almost a decade ago, I remember I was like, you know what, this is so far in the future, there's a pretty good chance I would have been eating a little bit of crow. But here we are 18 months from 2020, especially when you look at the next recession is going to hit 2023. I think the terrible 20s are going to be just that. And kind of one of the poster childs that unfortunately is going to wind up being a huge part of our theoretically operational fleet has been the LCS. And just as you mentioned, people are tired of reading about Afghanistan. I think people are numb to LCS program, which over a decade after commissioning of Hull 1 still can't effectively deploy anything but a presence mission and PMC on surface. But you know, LCS has reached a point, it's openly mocked up on the hill. It's almost become its own idiom. And we're looking past coming up on some way to try to repair that lost opportunity for that smaller surface combatant, FFGX. I've written about my preference has been the Franco-Italian Frem. Go ahead and license build it here. But there's lots of other players in there. Looking at the tea leaves inside the Beltway, do you have a fingertip, Phil, on what the general trends or changing odds might be on FFGX as we wait for the call?
I think it's going to be very unlikely for the U.S. to buy even a foreign design if it's licensed and built here. I don't have any insight into this, except for the fact that the U.S. Navy specifically, as we know so well, has a preference for things that it designed and wants to build and then wants to operate. The not invented here phenomenon is just a huge plank of the way that service makes decisions. And I watched for years as people in Congress, and this goes back to the days when former Congressman the late Ike Skelton was the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. And I remember being at a hearing with him years ago with then Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Gary Roughhead, and this is three CNOs ago, and he said, what about this great ship the Coast Guard is building, the National Security Cutter? I saw a picture of it. I was down in Pascagoula, and it seems fantastic. Why don't you guys just build a whole bunch of those and use it for these purposes that you want for the literal combat ship? And CNO Roughhead at the time said something like, oh, that's a good idea, Congressman. You know, we'll look into that. And, of course, we knew he had no intention of looking into that. And I think one reason the Navy didn't like it is they didn't like that it was a Coast Guard ship. And that came about or you heard that in comments made by Navy leaders for many years until finally the whole notion of that ship becoming a frigate arguably went away. And maybe it'll come back again and maybe it won't. But at least it has the advantage of being an American design and one that an American shipyard could build. Something like the Frem is just something that's too – I can imagine it being considered too European. But at the same time, you know, we could be getting into a new era. And if these service officials are as bearish as it appears they are about LCS, then there's going to be a huge incentive for them to get onto something no matter what it is. I did not cover this hearing and I was not there, but my former colleague David Larder of Defense News was at a thing recently with the current SecNav, Mr. Spencer, and he got into a fight with Bradley Byrne, who's the congressman from Alabama, whose district includes the shipyard where the even-numbered LCSs are built. And they were complaining about how the Navy didn't have one in the budget this year, and Byrne said that was undercutting the industrial base, and they had kind of an angry tiff back and forth. And I remember laughing about how, you know, these guys are arguing about a ship that doesn't do anything. You know, I can't remember how many there are in service now, all the even number ones in San Diego and the odd number ones in Mayport, but they don't go anywhere. They don't do anything. And so all this argument about adding more of them or who's going to get to build which one seems totally academic because the service appears to continue to just try and struggle to figure out how they're actually going to man train and equip these things to be able to put them into the force. I know that the CNO and Fleet Forces Command say that they're kind of ready to have this spike in operations. And one of these days, a day is going to come where we're going to look up and there's going to be 5 or 10 of these things deployed all over the world. And they're going to be doing all these different missions and they'll be customized in a way they were supposed to be interchangeable in the previous era. But I don't know when that day is going to get here. Clearly, the incentive to start with a new design, to build something that's bigger, that's got more systems aboard, that dispenses with a lot of the illusions, as they've proven to be, of the original LCS concept, has got to be a big incentive for the Navy. The problem is, you know, are they going to be able to afford it? And can the Navy internally restrain the impulses to turn it into another guided missile destroyer, because that's also going to be the death knell for any potential future frigate, where if there's all this pressure internally to equip it with more sensors and more weapons and make it heavier and make it more multi-mission focused in the way that the incumbent destroyers are, you're going to wind up with something that just turns out to be a smaller destroyer, but isn't any cheaper and isn't any quicker to build than the DDGs that are already in production. So I think it's a fascinating story. I have no idea which way it's going to go.
Well, we got about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to throw out a real short question on Russia and China, which I know you've been able to answer that time. Russia's use of the social, I'll call it the exploitation of our social media to stir up things in our elections and other areas, and I'd like you to kind of talk about that a little bit, and then also China's rise and what the Obama administration called the pivot to the Pacific. Where are we going with these things?
You know, that's a great question. There were a lot of people in DOD who said when the Obama people came along that it wasn't a pivot, it was just a pirouette. They were going to do a big spin around because, you know, as you guys know, the Navy and the Marine Corps especially, and of course the Air Force in Guam and Japan and South Korea, was in the Western Pacific the entire time, and it never went anywhere. And in fact, all it was an even greater focus by those military services on that theater by the commitment of ships and aircraft there. With respect to the active measures campaign that the Russians have been waging against the United States, this is where I focus a lot of my time at work now, trying to figure out what's going on, trying to figure out where it's going to go next. The social media agitation aspect of it gets a lot of attention because everyone has a Facebook account and a Twitter account, and there are American companies and American figures, people like your Mark Zuckerbergs, people like your Tumblrs and Reddit and so forth, who we all know, and you can make them into accomplices or culprits as part of that. But it actually arguably isn't even the most effective part of the whole active measures. If you think back to 2016, the state-sponsored hackers, the advanced persistent threat that we later found out was the Russian GRU and FSB security services, were hacking into people's emails and releasing incredibly embarrassing secrets about them to totally change the subject in the campaign and to really make them look bad in a way that you kind of can't do anything about. You know, if you think about all the terrible things you've said in email over the years, as I certainly have, and you imagine somebody getting in there and putting that out on Front Street for all reporters to write about and TV networks to cover, that can't be undone. You know, the government's not going to compel CNN not to run stories about some campaign official or some politician's emails. And we're living in a new era where that's going to be, according to Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats and other national security officials, that's going to be the world that we live in, at least for 2018 and at least for 2020. And we had a piece on NPR over the weekend on NPR.org, you can find it, where I make the point that I'm not sure how well this is sunk in for a lot of people, that this Russian active measures phenomenon from 2016 till now is basically the diagnosis of a chronic disease, at least for the medium term. You can't shoot a magic bullet and make it go away. There's no amount of money you can spend and sew up all aspects of American digital life or the way that elections work at the state level, certainly, and go to a zero threat type of environment. And it's going to be an interesting and probably very difficult phenomenon for our country to get used to this, especially if at the topmost level of the administration there isn't a big focus on doing things from a cybersecurity level or a national security perspective to try and dissuade these foreign governments, especially the Russians, from waging these active measures. If there is, that could change. But this is something we're going to live with for a long time, and it's going to be important for everyone to kind of realize that that's the world that we're living in now.
Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of people haven't realized how this is going to roll out, especially for many people who have decades of a digital footprint. When you reach the point also that medical records are hackable because they're online, surveillance technology, the ability to spy on anyone, anyplace, anywhere with audio and video, and then you roll into the ability to fake video to the point you can't tell the difference. It's almost as if you're going to be in the public life, it's going to bias towards people that are even more shameless and brazen than the environment we have right now, because you're going to have to be shameless and brazen to be able to deal with the type of junk that's going to be thrown at you the minute you break above the background noise. But for a reporter and a press person, I don't think we're entering a more boring time. If anything, it's going to be hard to keep track of. Your 24-hour news cycle is going to be compacted into about, what do you think, 90-minute news cycle?
Yeah, that's where I am now. I don't even know what day it is anymore. It's actually a really tough problem because I have to go on the radio live, and I have to say to the host or say to a guest, oh, remember that when that thing took place the other day, was it last week? Was it a month ago? Was it 6 months ago? When you're living in this constant spin cycle, time stops having any meaning for you, which means you have no idea when things took place. You're just constantly living in it. And if you're walking on a tightrope without a net, sometimes you can embarrass yourself and say, oh, that thing from yesterday. And then somebody else on the show says, well, actually, that was a month ago. And you just don't even know anymore.
Yeah, I feel your pain, my friend. And hey, it's been a great hour having you, Phil. I just want to make sure all our listeners know, if you want to keep track of Phil, I tell people all the time, if you're not following Phil Ewing at PHILEWING, if you're not following Phil on Twitter, you're really missing a great resource. Where are some other places that people can look for you? Look for reporting, or if they're regular NPR listeners, when could they hear your dulcet tones coming over the radio?
Well, you can't ever blame me for being on the radio, because when that happens, it usually means that something has gone wrong or somebody called in sick that day. So I hope nobody holds that against me. But if you have a public radio station in your town and you want to throw them a couple of bucks, God bless you for doing so. Or you can always find our work, both audio and digital, on our website, npr.org.
Well, there we go. And Phil, again, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to next opportunity.
Okay, guys. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming, Phil. It's been great.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.